You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now we'll let The Simpsons set this conversation up. Does this song sound familiar?
Jingle bells, Batman smells, Robin laid an egg. Batmobile lost its wheel, the Joker got away. Hey!
That's singer Robert Goulet on The Simpsons with a holiday parody song that's well known to Bart and the kids and to real life kids from multiple generations. It's just one example of something called child lore. The games like Miss Mary Mac or songs like Ring Around the Rosie or those folding fortune tellers that end up as a kind of shared kid culture. Our next guest looked into how child lore gets started and how it changes depending on when and where you learned it. And we want to hear from you. Do you have stuff like this you remember from your own childhood? Clapping games, urban legends, parody songs, you name it. What memories do you have of sharing that stuff with other kids? If you have young people in your life now, do you recognize some of their child culture from your days growing up? Or do you see some new kinds? You can let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Julie Beck is a senior editor at The Atlantic who oversees the family section. She's also the creator of the Friendship Files. She wrote about how these childhood traditions get passed down in the piece, Why Did We All Have the Same Childhood? I talked to her last month. Here's that conversation. Well, reading your piece, I was like, oh yeah, I remember all this stuff, and I probably hadn't thought about it in literally decades. What got you interested in taking a closer look at this child lore?
Yeah, well, before I knew that it was called child lore, in my mind, I was just sort of thinking of it as like the memes of the schoolyard, because I was thinking about like how these things spread and we all seem to know them. You know, there's always like BuzzFeed listicles or whatever of like things only 90s kids remember. And it's like the cool S or, yeah, like the cootie catchers or all these things. And I had always, sort of idly wondered, how is it that we do all know these things? Because it's not like kids have like a robust, you know, network, across the nation. So yeah. And then when I looked into it, it turned out that really this is a subgenre of folklore. And it's folklore that is specific to kids and kid culture.
And child lore, reading your piece and looking into it more, it covers a lot of ground. You mentioned a couple, those origami cootie catchers, so-called the fortune-telling things that I didn't have the folding talent to make when I was a kid. little tricks with calculators, little art things, songs. This is a lot of ground we're covering here.
Yeah, it's a really broad category. Really anything that is a piece of culture that kids have adopted and made their own could be child lore. So that can be all of the examples you mentioned. That can be jump rope rhymes, nursery rhymes, clapping games, even like something as small as like typing out naughty words on a calculator, right? Like that can be child lore too. So yeah, it really does span a wide array of things and it can kind of ebb and flow. But what was the most interesting to me was how many of these things persist through the generations. One of the folklorists I spoke to was much older than me and is British, and we shared a ton of the same references. So I thought that was pretty cool, just the longevity of it.
Talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic, looking at child lore, the little games and customs and songs and tricks and things like that that are common to kids, as Julie was just saying, from different generations, often from different places. You can join in. Do you have a memory of these things yourself? Or are you seeing it right now in your own kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, Julie, a big question you tackled here is, a lot of these things were around a long time, of course, before we had the internet, yet they spread like memes. What do we know about how the same customs might be, as you just mentioned, in the United States and England and in a generation or two apart? How do these things spread?
Yeah, so the answer is kind of simple, and maybe you will find that disappointing, but it's actually pretty cool. It really is something that catches on to the degree that children want to teach it to each other. And so within a school, you know, older generations will be teaching the younger generations. Within the home, like siblings are really important, especially, you know, if you have an older sibling, you probably think they're really cool and want to emulate whatever they're doing. And then something that was mentioned to me as well was really the power of like cousins, which seems really random, but like those are often the closest peers that kids have who don't go to their school, but they do see them regularly. So there's like cross-pollination happening with cousins, or if new kids move to new schools and they bring their lore from their old school. So all of those things seem really simple, and yet like if something is catchy enough and like cool enough to kids, like that will be enough to really spread it like across the country.
You also write, I think about the game of tag, which just appears like we're running around tagging each other. I remember who taught me tag, and there are different permutations involving often diseases around tag. Could you talk about what you learned about that really basic playground game?
Yeah, I mean, the origin of tag, I could not tell you. Like, it is timeless. It came from everywhere and nowhere. But it kids take that structure and they iterate it, depending on what they're interested in or what they're thinking about. And like, obviously, you've probably played a lot of variations yourself, like freeze tag or the floor is lava or whatever. But it's also a structure that they can use to kind of work through what is going on around them. And so a colleague of mine, Kate Cray, actually wrote a piece in like March or April 2020 about how kids were starting to play coronavirus tag. And parents were worried, like, does this mean, their kids are really traumatized and upset? Should we be worried about this? And, experts told her at the time, like, no, this is so healthy. Like, this is play is how children work through things. And when I was reporting this story, and I mentioned that to a folklorist, they said, I would not be surprised if in Victorian times they were playing cholera tag or something like that. Like it's just a structure that is there and that kids build on with their interests or whatever they're working through. And I think that's part of what makes it, so long-lived.
And speaking of grown-ups being worried about kids, I think there's a sense like, oh, there's the internet and screens and social media, and now kids are doing childhood wrong. Is this killing those old traditional childhood games, the interconnected world we have?
Oh my goodness, no. And in fact, like every single folklorist that I spoke to or whose like book I read, every single one like had the same thing that they wanted to emphasize, which is that adults like throughout history have always said kids don't know how to play anymore. And they're blaming, whatever the technology of the day is, probably like today it would be internet and TikTok, and like when it was TV, like TV was, the problem. But they seem to think that part of the reason for that is because like child lore is sort of like a language and a culture that is of kids, by kids, for kids, and it is not for us. And so we don't always recognize it when we see it. We might just think like kids are running around on the playground screaming and going wild, but like to them, it is a game that like has a purpose and an organized principle, and like we just don't always see that.
Another thing that's fun is, regional variation. Things are different. I think when you're talking to the English expert, you mentioned Jingle Bells, Batman Smells. What does Robin do?
Oh, yeah. Well, so you played the clip from The Simpsons, which is the one that I know, which is Robin laid an egg. And he said that he grew up singing Robin Flew Away. I like laid an egg better, but to each their own. But yeah, that is another element of it, right? Is like there is consistency, like remarkable consistency, and there is also variation, depending on the time you grew up, where exactly you grew up, what was cool at your school, that sort of thing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I believe Ring Around the Rosie is talking about the plague.
I have heard that. Is this one you grew up playing yourself, Susie, doing Ring Around the Rosie?
Yeah.
I remember when I was a little kid, I did
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. And ashes, ashes, we all fall down. I believe is when they burned down towns. They would seal a town, not let anybody out, and just burn the whole thing down to try to stop the plague from growing.
Susie, thanks for the call. I've heard that, Julie. I've also heard that it's wrong, and I'm not sure where we're settled on the origins of Ring Around the Rosie. The tricky thing is, like you were saying with tag, it may be that we never know where these things end up coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, professional folklorists like can actually trace some of these things, probably not all of them, much better than you know, me, a random person, can. And I can't, I don't want to, you know, commit on air to something I'm not sure about, but I'm pretty sure that in the book of the folklorist, the British folklorist, Steve Rowe, that I read, he had debunked one of those things. I can't remember if it was Ring Around the Rosie or some other kids game that's like associated with the plague. But it seemed like more questionable that that actually was the origin. Like that sort of maybe folklore in itself, that like now we think that it was, you know, the plague at the time. So it's like folklore on top of folklore.
I love it. Thanks a lot for bringing that up. We're talking to Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic, who oversees their family section, with us today to talk about her latest piece looking at traditions of childhood, otherwise known as child lore. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember some of these? Are you just thinking back about them now? Maybe something you haven't thought of in a good long while, depending on how old you were. What is one of these things you might remember from your school? A version of tag. Did you use those folding things to answer fortune teller type questions? Does he or she like me? That kind of important question to a fourth or fifth grader. Other songs or parodies or games, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about child lore, those clapping games, silly song parodies, and so much more that have become childhood traditions. Julie Beck stays with us from The Atlantic. She wrote a recent piece about this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a memory of one of these, a question, if you remember who taught something like this to you, well, that's a tall order maybe, but if you do, I'd love to hear it. 800-642-1234, a jumping jack, a rhyme that you did, or I'm blanking on the word, jump rope thing that you did, a rhyme that you did. Let us know. 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Bryn is with us in North Freedom. Bryn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Bryn?
MASH, the person on air may instantly know what that is, but mansion, apartment, shack, house, a game on a piece of paper with pencil marks and figuring out what your future holds.
Oh, wow. Okay. That is just starting to come back to me. I don't remember if we called it MASH, but yeah, it was like kind of a weird fortune telling thing. Do you remember any of your fortunes, Bryn, from back in the day? Oh, I think we lost Bryn. Julie, is that one you ran across?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I never forgot about MASH. It's hard to describe to people who don't know, because this is not a visual medium, but you know, you would write, it would be sort of like a fortune telling game for your future, right? And so as the caller mentioned, you'd write MASH on the top, and that was like, are you going to live in a mansion, apartment, shack, or house? Yeah, you'd put all your crushes on there, whether that was like celebrity crushes or people from school. And then you would do, you know, sort of like a random number generating thing. And then you'd count it out. And that's like who you were going to marry, where you were going to live, how many kids you would have, like all of that.
Thanks a lot for bringing that up, Bryn. You know what? I don't remember if I did that. I know my kids did it. That's why it seems so familiar. Bryn, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Julie, are we seeing new things like this getting created now, not just passed on, but new, whole new things or new versions of them?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about child lore is that it is sort of a paradox in that it is like very stable, but also always in flux, right? Like, so there are all kinds of things that are child lore that don't get passed on, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, because they're kind of specific to the time that they come up in, right? So, for example, when I was a kid in elementary school, like my friends and I used to pretend to be the witches from Hocus Pocus on the playground, and we would play that all the time. And, you know, after that movie was not super popular anymore, I doubt anybody was like thinking to play that, although they did just put out a sequel, so maybe it's coming back. Yeah, there's all kinds of things that are tied to pop culture. Kids love to play, you know, games related to that. And then there's probably also just like trends that come up in a school, and they don't necessarily become super widespread. So all of that is child lore. The distinction is, you know, the pop culture itself. So like Paw Patrol is not child lore. Like that was made by adults for children, but the games that kids play when they're pretending to be Paw Patrol characters, that is child lore, because what makes it child lore is kids making it their own.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Ginny on the road by Dodgeville. Ginny, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about Ginny?
Well, I grew up on a dairy farm in southwest Wisconsin, so we kind of had to make our own entertainment. And I remember three games. One was called Red Rover, Red Rover. And then you'd say, send, you know, like Robbie right over. And that kid would like run across and try to break like through a line of kids holding hands. And then the other one was a Annie Annie Over, where you threw a ball over the roof of like a, we had a smokehouse. So the person on the other side would catch it. And then they had to try to figure out which side the person who threw the ball was coming, and if you hit them with the ball before they got all the way around, then you won, you know. And then the last one was Cat's Cradle, where you used a string and you kind of move the string around, and then you pass it from back and forth. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was a playground. Thank you so much for sharing those. I was in southeastern Michigan growing up. I was Robbie, and I played Red Rover. In my head, I was really good at Red Rover. I don't think I have the statistics to back those up. But, Julie, Ginny had some great examples. Those are exactly the sorts of things we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew Red Rover, and I knew Cat's Cradle, but I didn't know the throwing over the roof game. I grew up in southeastern Michigan as well, so we played a lot of Red Rover. I was not good at it. I've never been like a good runner. I could never break through their hands. So that one wasn't my favorite, but I do remember.
Ginny, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic, talking about child lore, those games, those little tricks, the fortune-telling thing, so much more that kids just know and pass on to each other and maybe change and reinvent. And it shows up at different places and times. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Julie, the mention of MASH, most of our Central Time producers seem to remember that fondly. Now, when you were telling people you were writing about this, did you have a lot of those moments like, oh, yeah, I remember that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I was reading through this book by the British folklorist called The Lore of the Playground, and just every page was, like, bringing back memories, like, of these clapping games that I used to play and, like, the sort of various rules for different, like, hopscotch games or, like, tag variations. Some of the things I had, you know, remembered over the years, but it's sort of like the Proustian Madeleine, right? Like, somebody mentions it and it just, like, comes flooding back all the memories.
I did a couple of the things you wrote about I hadn't heard of, but I was able to watch YouTube videos about them. I don't, do you think that's going to help? I mentioned, you know, is technology going to kill these things? Is technology going to help amplify some of these things?
I think so, yeah. One of the researchers I spoke with, her specialty is kind of, you know, new media and play. And she mentioned that, yeah, sometimes kids will look up the rules for this or that clapping game online. So that is another way that it spreads. And it makes me wonder if the sort of regional variants will become a little bit more homogenized if kids are kind of learning in this more universal way online. It's not going to kill play, but it might like shift the way that kids learn these things.
Let's go back to our callers. John is with us in Osseo. John, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm actually a teacher in Osseo. And at the end of my class, if we're done with our schoolwork, I have a softball that I let the kids throw around the room, and they come up with their own rules. I've never introduced a game to them, but every day there's something new. Like, well, today let's throw it behind our back, or today you have to be on one foot when you throw it. You bounce it off your, if it bounces off your hand, you're out. It's just very interesting watching them create games as they go.
I love it, John. Thanks. And that speaks, Julie, to the inventiveness of children, I think.
Yeah, that's so fun. I mean, I don't know if the softball game is going to sweep the nation, although it might. But it's like what makes it really special is that like it's about the kids' agency and them coming up with what is interesting and fun and stimulating to them. And that's really the case for all of child lore, whether it's something that only exists in our college classroom or, you know, across the whole country.
Thanks for the call, John. Time for one more caller. Lori is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lori, hi.
just tuned in on the radio, but I remember the game, the clapping game. Oh, Mary, Mac, all dressed in black, black, black. Then you cross your arms and go down.
Right.
Pat your legs and clap your whoever you're doing it with.
Lori, thanks for that. Julie, I mentioned that as one example, but we haven't talked about those clapping and rhyming games, including, that's a big one, Mary Mac.
Yeah, I loved those. I remember Mary Mac, and there was like a bunch of other ones. And again, like not a visual medium, so hard to like explain. But yeah, they were really fun. And I think there's like been a ton of different regional variations on like how people do those rhymes too.
Lori, thanks for that call. And Julie, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was really fun.
That's Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic, who oversees the family section. She was with us today to talk about her latest piece there. It's called Why Did We All Have the Same Childhood? Looking at how childhood traditions, child lore is shared. You can keep sharing yours, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, one you remember from your own childhood, one you've seen maybe in your own kid's life. You can also email us to let us know about those childhood memories. What games did you play with friends? Are there ones you still could sing today? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the debt ceiling is looming closer once again. Will Congress move it or risk a big economic hit around the world? We'll get the latest on the politics surrounding debt ceiling, a standoff between Republicans in the House and particular on the White House on whether changes need to be made before that debt ceiling gets approved. And a philosopher makes the case that animals are beings, not things, and that we humans need to take responsibility for their well-being, especially in cases where we have caused them harm. On purpose, accidentally, you name it. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, find out what the science says about alcohol and its connections to depression and anxiety. A mental health expert joins us to talk about the benefits of a dry January. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, enhanced food share benefits will end next month, according to a recent announcement. A Wisconsin expert on hunger tells us what that can mean for the thousands of families that participate in the state's food share program. First, you may have heard about Dry January or Drynuary, where people give up alcohol for the first month of the year. Our next guest says doing something like that can be a good chance to reevaluate our relationship with alcohol and its role in our lives. For many people who are moderate drinkers, alcohol is used as a tool for relaxation or stress relief, maybe a way to overcome social anxiety. But in a new piece in the Washington Post, our guest says alcohol can actually make anxiety even worse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried a dry January or another way of taking time away from drinking or cutting back? How did it make you feel? Have you quit drinking altogether? What's it like to be alcohol-free in Wisconsin? Have you noticed a connection between maybe moderate alcohol use and anxiety in your own life? Call 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Richard Friedman is professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. Dr. Friedman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I want to start with our target audience here. Sometimes we talk about chronic heavy drinking or binge drinking. Here, I think a lot of who we're talking about here are going to be moderate drinkers. Can you talk about our working definition of that?
Right. So, well, you know, it keeps changing. But generally speaking, what most people think about as, you know, moderate drinking is in the range of, let's say, you know, 5 to 6 drinks a week. And anything that's more than that is more than a little bit that's moderate. And the reason it changes is because people have different ideas because there's different information about the effects of alcohol at different levels of drinking. So there's not entirely great definition of what constitutes, you know, let's say optimal drinking.
a big part of the problem with the link between alcohol and anxiety, sort of the upsides and downsides, you write, is that the upsides, the things you get out of it, happen right away. A lot of the negative stuff may be delayed by a few hours or even a couple of days. Let's talk about the science of that a little bit. First of all, why does that instant positive feeling, if we have that from drinking, happen so quickly?
Right. So the reason is alcohol is absorbed very, very quickly into the bloodstream and then into the brain. And so its effects are, you know, initially you feel, you know, mildly calm and relaxed and maybe a little bit euphoric, socially more comfortable, sometimes even a little disinhibited. But that happens really quickly, within minutes, actually. And some of that depends on how quickly you drink. The faster you drink your glass of wine or beer or shot of whiskey, the faster you're going to notice those effects. So the rewarding effects of alcohol happen immediately. There's just no, you don't have to wait long at all. And, but what happens later is alcohol is metabolized from the body within a few hours, you know, usually within 4 to 6 hours, and then it's gone. And when the alcohol's gone from your body and your brain, that's when all the negative effects of alcohol happen, meaning your anxiety level can actually go up. And if you drink before bed, like most people, you realize that you're suddenly wide awake, like a light bulb was turned on, because your body has metabolized the alcohol and it's now gone. So you're irritable and awake and anxious, kind of the mirror image of the, you know, positive effects of alcohol. Or maybe it happens the next day. And, you know, the next day you wake up and you all you remember was how good that drink was at night before, but you don't actually connect the anxiety in the late morning or afternoon with the very thing that's probably made it worse, which was your drink at night.
And this is unfortunate, I think ironic for a lot of people, because it's a cliche almost. Yeah, you feel stressed out. You have a drink to calm down. There's internet memes about how much we rely on that glass of wine or whatever it might be in the evening. What happens if we, I guess, self-medicate, if we treat alcohol as a medicine for stress and anxiety?
So it's actually a pretty bad treatment for depression and anxiety, because it may initially make you feel better, but invariably it's going to make you feel worse the next day. And in order to sustain the effect, you have to drink more the following day, which then sets you up for this kind of self-sustained, you know, downward spiral, where more drinking creates more anxiety the next day, which then drives you to want to drink more to cover up or medicate that anxiety. And what you don't realize is you're trapped in this vicious cycle in which the thing you think is your friend and helping you is actually making you more anxious and depressed.
We're talking to Dr.
It's just that there's a time delay.
We're talking to Dr. Richard Friedman from the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College, talking about alcohol as a stress and anxiety and depression relief, a very bad one, he's saying, that tends to make us more stressed out, anxious, and or depressed over time. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eric joins us now in Portage. Eric, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Eric?
Well, I'm 52, and I've been meaning to quit drinking for the last 15 years, and I was going to quit tomorrow. And so finally my doctor prescribed me naltrexone, and it took my urges away, and I've been off alcohol for 6 months.
Eric, congratulations on that. Can I ask, if I may, how would you describe your drinking before that? Moderate, heavy, bingy, what did that look like?
I'd say medium. I was like 2 to 6 beers a night, but my wife doesn't drink, so it kind of made me kind of a jerk to be buzzed every night when she doesn't drink. And I don't know, that naltrexone really helped a lot take the urges away.
Eric, thank you so much for sharing that experience with... Oh, actually, no, don't go yet, Eric. How are you feeling since you stopped drinking 2 to 6 beers a day?
I feel great. I have more energy. I'm not afraid to drive, and I get along with my wife a little better.
All right. Well, that's good news, Eric. Thank you so much. Dr. Friedman, first of all, the benefits Eric had, you hear this from patients you work with.
Yes, all the time. And first of all, I'm so glad for Eric that, you know, he was able to do it so easily. You know, he his doctor gave him naltrexone, which is a commonly used medicine that helps decrease the desire to want to drink. And if you do drink when you're taking naltrexone, it makes the effects of alcohol less rewarding because it blocks opiate receptors in the brain. And so, Eric, that's just great that it was so effective and that the benefits are so positive.
And Eric also mentioned Dr. Freeman getting that medication for somebody who says, okay, gosh, I want to stop drinking for a while or for a long time, but I seem to have trouble doing it. When do we go to a doctor and say, hey, can I try a medication like this?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I think, you know, you try first to do it yourself, and it's hard to do it, obviously, because, you know, there's a rewarding effect initially for alcohol. So there's all kinds of supports that you can get even before you go to the doctor. You can go to Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, which is really wonderful, a great support network for people who are having trouble with alcohol. And you can get a sponsor who can help you. And that by itself could actually make it much easier to stop drinking, because you're going to have a lot of motivation and you're going to have a network of colleagues and peers who are going to basically share their experience, and you're not going to feel alone. And of course, you should go to your doctor just to be sure you don't have any medical problems that are being caused by your drinking. And sometimes, you know, medicines like naltrexone can be prescribed to help cut down on your urge to drink and make it easier to stop it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Eric. Tom joins us next in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Yeah, you were talking about the anxiety. And my question is, I'm an alcoholic, and a lot of us have trouble dealing with anxiety even years later. Did our anxiety cause us to drink, or does the drink cause the anxiety?
Oh, interesting question, Tom. Yeah, chicken or the egg there, Dr. Freeman.
Yeah, well, Tom, that's a wonderful question, because I think it's often both. Sometimes people have a problem with anxiety earlier, long before they started drinking, and they start to drink in order to medicate the anxiety as a treatment for the anxiety, which then makes the anxiety worse. So you could have, let's say, a pre-existing anxiety problem and then be predisposed to getting in trouble with alcohol because you're using alcohol to treat the anxiety. And there's also the possibility that, you know, once you start drinking, it sets up a situation in which you experience anxiety that's the biological effect of too much alcohol. So it could be either scenario. You could have both.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. We are talking about the connections between alcohol, anxiety, and depression with Dr. Richard Freeman, professor of clinical psychiatry, director of the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you trying this dry January thing, taking a break at least from drinking? Do you feel a connection between alcohol and anxiety, whether it's mild or moderate levels of drinking or beyond? Call in with your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Dr. Richard Freeman, professor of clinical psychiatry, director of the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. In a piece in the Washington Post, he highlights the links between alcohol, anxiety, and depression. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen that connection in your own life? Are you taking a break or cutting back on drinking during dry January? Do you feel any different? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott joins us now in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Good afternoon. I grew up in a family that used alcohol every single day, and I was programmed to do the same. And I'm in my 60s now, and I'm still programmed, and I was reading in a book just today about this and how we are programmed neurologically in certain directions for certain things. And I start convincing myself in the afternoon and towards evening that I want a drink. And the thing is, guys, I enjoy it. But what I'd like to bring up, the additional thing that I'd like to add to your conversation today, is it doesn't only take the edge off of stress initially, it takes the edge off of the stress, but it also takes the edge off spiritually. I work a spiritual practice, and it takes the edge off of that.
Interesting. Scott, yeah. Thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Friedman, he sees it taking the edge off of the good stuff. We don't enjoy the positive stuff as much as we might, Scott says, with alcohol.
Yes, Scott. Well, thank you for that. Such an interesting experience. I mean, you know, with regard to, you know, learning this, mm-hmm. being brought up in a family where everybody, you know, as a matter of just habit, drank, of course, you learned that this is just, you know, it's part of life. It's something that, you know, everybody in the family did. What is interesting also about what you said is it doesn't just have effects on things like anxiety and depression, but even your experience of, you know, religious feeling. And it makes me wonder whether, to some extent, if you have had alcohol and you're very, very calm and relaxed, you know, there's less of a drive to, you know, want to, you know, calm yourself with other means or center yourself with other means, like, you know, thinking about, you know, religious practice. It's fascinating.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Scott. We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page, Gabe writes, I'm trying dry January. He says, I've had the energy to exercise more. My sleep has been much better. My mood much more stable. Spending less money, especially when dining out, can be kind of dull at times. Gabe says, I find I've been drinking more caffeine and eating more sugar. And when you aren't drinking, you notice how intense and pervasive drinking culture is in Wisconsin, for better and for worse. Dr. Friedman, for someone doing what Gabe is doing and doing dry January, what do you recommend they think of as February rolls around?
It's such a great question. I mean, it may be that it's such a positive experience to see how vivid life is when you don't have alcohol and how alert you are and how much more energy you have, that you just might decide to extend dry January into a different relationship with alcohol going forward entirely. Maybe, you know, it's a wake-up call that alcohol at the level you were drinking before really decreases the quality of your life in a way that you either want to have as little as possible or none at all.
We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us now in Stevens Point. Chris, hello.
Hello. I just had a question. I also grew up in a family that really had alcohol in their lives every day in one form or another, if it was sometimes too much. I've been sober now for 30 years, but the my grandfather at one time, I was told that my grandfather didn't drink at all, but he did have a drink first thing in the morning when he got up, about 5 o'clock. He would have a brandy or a something like that, just a shot, first thing in the morning. What are there any health benefits to doing, you know, to drinking like that?
Chris, thanks for the call. Now, Dr. Friedman, I remember there was, I think in the 80s and 90s, you'd see little studies saying, oh, a drink maybe may have these modest health benefits. It seems like I don't see that kind of thing so much anymore.
Right. So Chris brings up a very interesting question, which gets to yours. And that is, usually when people drink in the morning, almost always, it's a sign that they have an alcohol problem, meaning that they are drinking in the morning because they feel, without that drink, nervous and edgy. And it's usually a sign of tolerance to alcohol. I would be surprised if it weren't the case. It's unusual to hear otherwise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as for the question of, you know, is there a level of alcohol which is healthy? The more we seem to learn about alcohol, the answer seems closer to, well, probably not. That, you know, it was thought that there's a benefit to very low levels of alcohol. But in terms of the studies that have been done recently, it's hard to show that those benefits are actually as real as we thought that they were.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. Sarah is with us next in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I was just saying that I did a self-experiment a few years ago where I was drinking like a beer every night with dinner, and then I'd go out on Friday nights with my friends and drink two or three or four, and I would had this low-grade depression, and I realized that I was waking up on Saturday mornings with a heavier sadness and kind of despair. So I thought, well, I'll try taking out the every night beer, and my depression went away.
Wow. Sarah, thanks for sharing that. Dr. Friedman, what do you think?
Sarah, that is a beautiful demonstration of the depressant effect of alcohol, and classic. So you notice that a modest amount during the week didn't have the effect, but if you have three beers the next morning, you would wake up feeling sad, down, low, because the alcoholic effect initially is relaxing, but hours later, it's actually a depressant. It brings about a feeling of low energy and depressed mood.
Sarah, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Dr. Friedman, Sarah did something that it seems like it's hard for people to do, including some of your patients, connecting the dots between the drink last night and that feeling this afternoon or over the weekend.
Yes, exactly. But she did a beautiful experiment. And, you know, she saw the results and they were conclusive for her.
Now, for people already dealing with, say, anxiety or depression, I mean, as you've said, self-medicating with alcohol doesn't seem to work. It makes things worse, probably. Does it also keep us from seeking out treatments that might help us?
Yes, that's a wonderful point. I think it does. I think largely it's because when people are trapped in the cycle of drinking and anxiety and depression, they actually don't realize that their attempts to make themselves feel better are actually making them feel worse and really going ahead to get treatment that would help them, like therapy or perhaps medication or both.
I want to look at our cultural attitudes toward drinking. A couple of our callers have mentioned, you know, growing up in families where daily alcohol was the norm. A couple of people on Facebook have talked about Wisconsin's pervasive drinking culture, as Gabe said. Are you hopeful that things like, a dry January or other projects like that might lead people to rethink their cultural connection to alcohol?
I think habits are not destiny, and we can change them. And I think that when you have experiences like dry January, your friends have experiences like your last caller mentioned, you can actually look at that and think, you know, maybe I could benefit by changing my behavior. So I think, you know, culture obviously has a powerful influence on us for good and bad. And it's possible through, you know, education to change aspects of culture for the better.
And finally, for people who are saying, you know, I'm a moderate drinker, but I don't want to give it up completely. Is there a benefit from going from moderate to, I don't know, occasional drinking?
I would say the answer depends on whether you experience something in everyday life that you think is less than desirable. Like, for example, suppose you said, you know, I don't really notice there are terrible effects of alcohol, but I'm kind of tired more than I used to be. Or my recall is not as sharp and fast as it was. Or I'm verbally not as fluent as I used to be. I would say, don't assume that's just age or the passage of time, and just do a very simple experiment. Cut back on the alcohol or stop it for a couple of weeks and observe how your life is and how you feel and how you think.
Dr. Friedman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Richard Friedman, director of the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. He joined us today for a look at the connections between alcohol and our mental health. If you're doing dry January or something like it, love to hear from you. We've got a post up over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, extended food share benefits from the early days of COVID-19 are going to end next month, according to a recent announcement. We'll find out what that means, who it could affect here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.